I'm speaking today with Joshua Oppenheimer about his extraordinary new film, The Act of Killing. The film's context is the mass murder of nearly a million people that took place in Indonesia beginning in 1965 and following the overthrow of their democratically elected government. For 8 years, Oppenheimer interviewed the perpetrators who spoke about, boasted about, and ultimately chose to reenact Hollywood-style their killings. The Act of Killing, with executive producers Werner Herzog and Errol Morris, opens in theaters on August 9th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Joshua.
Thank you so much.
Now, I have seen many, many films and documentaries on war, on genocide, and myself have interviewed Khmer Rouge officials still living quite comfortably in Cambodia, but your film left me speechless. How did you come to make this film?
Well, I actually first went to Indonesia in 2001 to make a film about a community of plantation workers who were struggling to organize a union in the aftermath of the Suharto dictatorship when unions had been illegal. And they desperately needed a union because the women workers were spraying a herbicide that was dissolving their livers slowly and killing them in their 40s. Mm-hmm. And they were working for a Belgian-owned plantation, oil palm plantation. And it turned out that the biggest obstacle they had in organizing a union was fear. Fear because their parents and grandparents had been in a strong plantation workers' union until 1965. They'd been accused of being communist sympathizers by virtue of their union membership, had been rounded up by the army, put in concentration camps, and then many of them dispatched by the army out to local death squads to be killed. And they were afraid this could happen to them again. And while we made this, this was 2001, 2002, while we were making this film, some of the survivors began to say, you know, to understand why we're afraid, film some of our neighbors who we know were perpetrators. And they might also tell you how our loved ones died, because we never actually had confirmation that they were dead. We just know they were taken away and never came back. And therefore, the families, in fact, had felt guilty even grieving or mourning for the loss of their relatives because they didn't have the closure that comes with knowing that someone had been told that someone had died. So I went on these dark and painful missions to neighbors' houses. I initially introduced myself with some caution, saying, you know, hi, I'm the foreigner living in this remote plantation village. And I just am coming to introduce myself, curious about who I was, a foreigner living in this plantation village. They invited me in, would serve me tea, and I would then ask sort of vague questions about their past. They were older, so I'd say, what did you do for a living? And immediately, they would start telling me stories of killing, because the killing was the most important thing they'd ever done, and it was the basis for any career they'd have ever since. And they would often tell me these grisly, graphic stories in front of their grandchildren, in front of their wives, and the families would look on bored as though they'd heard this stuff dozens of times before. And we finished the film about the plantations, and I had this feeling that about the plantation workers' union, I had this feeling that I had wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust to find the Nazis still totally in power. You mentioned that you've interviewed Khmer Rouge, former Khmer Rouge officials still living comfortably. That said, the Khmer Rouge has officially been removed from power, and there are tribunals
Absolutely.
For some Khmer Rouge leaders, and places of execution like the Tuol Sleng prison and the killing fields have been turned
Yes.
into museums. In Indonesia, that's not the case. And I felt that this situation, that you know, the impunity after genocide was so profoundly important, yet not at all extraordinary, in the sense that I started this journey with oil palm plantation workers who were making our vegetable oil and the oil palm in our skin cream, the palm oil that's in our skin cream. And I realized that this kind of impunity in the aftermath of atrocity demands whatever it takes of me and needs to be exposed as something utterly ordinary, as the underbelly of our reality, not as this distant reality on the other side of the world that's only interesting as a kind of case study. So I went back immediately after making this first film, The Globalization Tapes, in 2001, 2002, to continue working in this community of survivors. and the we would work together. We would film. Like every time we would film, word had got out that I was interested in 1965, in the genocide, and the military would come and stop us at every shoot. They would come, they would impound our camera, they would take our tapes, which fortunately they were unable to play with their equipment, and they would detain us. And it was scary for all of us. It was difficult to get anything shot, and it was particularly frightening for the survivors. So we went to Jakarta to meet with the broader Indonesian human rights community and asked, is this too dangerous? And if so, should we stop? Everybody said, no, you must not stop. You're onto something terribly important. Mm. We need a film that exposes for Indonesians what they already know. And therein lies, I think, an important point about the nature of art, that art is not about showing us something we don't know. Art is genuinely about showing us painful truths that everybody knows and is too afraid to talk about and is perhaps too afraid even to remember. So the human rights community and the survivors said, no, we need a film that comes to Indonesia like the child in the emperor's new clothes, pointing at the king, saying, look, the king is naked, everybody. Everyone knows it, but has been too afraid to say it, and perhaps so afraid that they've forgotten even that they know it. They've forgotten even the reality that's before their eyes. So one of the survivors said, if it's too dangerous or difficult to film us, keep filming the perpetrators. You're finding out what happened. Yes. In their boasting, the audience can see why we're so afraid. And they also will get a glimpse of the nature of this whole regime. The rotten core of this whole regime lies in the boasting of the perpetrators. So I went back. I started filming every perpetrator I could find across the plantation region. I'd go to the ones I'd already filmed and say, introduce me to any others you know. They would all boast. After boasting in their living rooms, they would say, hey, I can take you to where we did it. I would always accept their invitations because I wanted to know what happened. They would launch into these spontaneous demonstrations of killings in the places where they killed. And then they would regret often afterwards that they had forgot to bring a machete along as a prop or a friend to play victims or costumes. And I started to wonder the questions I was asking started to shift from what happened to why are these men boasting? What is the nature of this apparent pride? Are they trying to convince themselves that it was right? Is it vanity? Are they trying to insist? Are they trying to terrorize the rest of their society? Is it all of the above? And so in search of answers about the nature of the boasting in the present, and in response to their openness, not as a lure to get them to open up,
right,
I started to propose this method. I said, look, your whole society is founded on these killings. It's one of the biggest killings in human history. Your whole life has been shaped by what you've done. I want to understand what it means to you and to your society. You want to show me what you've done. So show me what you've done, however you wish. I'll film the process. I'll film any reenactments. And we'll combine these things to try and answer these questions in a new form of documentary film.
And now you say that you interviewed 41 perpetrators before you found Anwar Kongo.
Anwar was the 41st.
Who is really the subject of this film, and shockingly a likable character because his emotions are so visible and so close to the surface. How did you find Anwar, and who were the people who you interviewed before who you decided, no, this will not be the subject?
The process of filming the first 40 perpetrators I met was in no way a casting process.
Right,
I was getting stories of world historical importance. I was getting reenactments that were exposing the rotten heart of a whole military regime, which in many ways is still intact. And what I anticipated doing, even when I first met Anwar, was making a film with all of these, a great number of these men together. I would simply ask each perpetrator to introduce me to other perpetrators they knew, working my way up the chain of command from the plantation region in the countryside to Medan, where the perpetrators became more and more these high-ranking members of a right-wing sort of fascist paramilitary group called Panchasila Youth, which is still very powerful. It still has 3 million members. And Anwar was notorious and famous and celebrated as a founding father of this organization. And I started to meet people who worked together when I got to Medan, when I got to the city where I made the act of killing. I met two members of the death squad, members of a newspaper office, or journalists and a publisher from a newspaper office where they were torturing and killing people. And so I would always interview people separately to see about what the others did, to confirm their stories, to make sure that I was getting, that they weren't lying to me. And when I met Anwar, I had this, and I didn't stop at Anwar, I should say. I continued up the chain of command. I interviewed former army generals in Jakarta and two retired CIA officers living outside of Washington, D.C., both of whom had provided death lists, lists of thousands of names of Indonesian intellectuals, union leaders, women's rights organizers, who the U.S. wanted dead. The U.S. basically wanted everybody on the left who was a, could in any way have been sympathetic to the Communist Party eliminated. The Communist Party in Indonesia was the biggest Communist Party in the world outside of a communist country. It was committed to obtaining power through elections. It was not a revolution. It didn't espouse armed revolution. And it was a perfectly legal party. So it, what happened in 65, it would be as if one day the army with the Republicans decided to kill all of the Democrats in the United States. That's how we have to understand it. Anyways, when I met Anwar, I lingered. And I think I lingered because his pain was close to the surface. And so when he would boast, he was more honest about his feelings. And in his, as he would tell me the way he killed, showing me how he did it, I had this feeling of real horrific memories that were present. And the boasting was more outrageous than anybody else's almost. I mean, there's a moment at the very first time I filmed him, and it's one of the first scenes in the film. He takes me up to a rooftop where he killed hundreds and hundreds of people, shows how he did it by garroting people with wire, and then says, and then starts dancing the cha-cha-cha in the place where he killed. And it was an astonishing, horrifying moment. Horrifying because the presence of his these horrific memories there were such that I left. I took him home after that shoot, dropped him off, and totally broke down in the car. And I had filmed 40 people before him, and that had not happened to me. There was something of the past really haunting him and shadowing him. And yet to dance the cha-cha-cha where he's killed hundreds of people is such, was so grotesque. It was such an assertion of denial. What I mean by that is to dance where you've killed 1,000 people, hundreds of people, is to deny the moral meaning of what you've done. And to, for him to do that and to see that he was haunted at the same time, I think made me profoundly curious, and I started to intuit that the boasting, which appeared to me to be, yes, a sign of impunity and a sign of the lack of humanity, the lack of remorse of the killers, might be the opposite. It might be a protective, self-protective, defensive effort to insist that what you did was justifiable, and the less confident you are about it, the more haunted you are about it, the more strident you are in your justification of what you've done, the more grotesque the celebration becomes. That's the paradox that I think the act of killing ultimately witnesses and exposes, that what appears to be a sign of the lack of humanity turns out to be the opposite, and it's a profoundly tragic paradox, because once you get away with killing and you are handed an excuse by the government for doing it, and we can make parallels to the U.S., impunity in the U.S. for torture, but once you get away with a crime of profound moral repugnance, and you justify it, then that almost necessitates that you this downward spiral into further evil, even though the reason you're justifying it is because you know it was wrong. So precisely because human beings are moral beings, and we justify our actions, we become worse. And an example, if you've killed 1,000 people for power and money, and the government hands you an excuse and says it was heroic, it was justified, it was great, now you have to oppress, and you cling to that excuse for dear life. Now you have to oppress the survivors, lest they should challenge your version of the events. Challenge your...
But there can be nothing that enters your version of reality.
That's right.
Because it's so fragile.
That's right.
So it, fragile, holding on to that.
Exactly.
And you can see that with Anwar, and that is why, even though he is talking about all of these murders, he is likable. I mean, it is that delicate part of the of humanity that kind of shows through. And we should say that Anwar and his sidekick, Arman, were movie buffs, right? So They have this, as Anwar says, he learned how to kill from watching Hollywood films. Marlon Brando, Al Pacino, and this adds this other kind of grotesque element to the killings. I'm speaking with filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer, whose amazing film, The Act of Killing, will be released in theaters this August. Tell me as well about this. This is a film about the past, but it's so much a film about the present. It's so much about the impunity. And you have some very disturbing scenes, really, of gangsters walking through the market now, kind of shaking down Chinese merchants. And you see the fear in their face. You see what they're living with now. Tell me about that a little more.
Well, I think the film witnesses and documents this downward spiral into evil and impunity, which is inevitable when there's been a founding original crime, which has been... which you've gotten away with and has been justified by the state. So, as I was saying a moment ago, once you've killed, you get away with it. Now you have to suppress the survivors so that they stay, they don't challenge your version of the events. You have to blame them for what happened because that's part of the justification. You have to blame, they deserved it. So then you can go with impunity and you can shake them down in markets. You can steal their land, which are things you hear about or see in The Act of Killing. And you even have to kill again, because if you've killed one group of people, got away with it, justified it, and then the government says, now kill this other group for much the same reason. Well, if you refuse the second time, it's tantamount to admitting it was wrong the first time. So, and all because they know it was wrong. I mean, that's the horrific thing. Because they're clinging to this fragile cover so that they can wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and not see a murderer, they have to cling to this justification, which then demands further sacrifice, further evil. And in fact the film witnesses, you see the vice president of Indonesia addressing a crowd of the paramilitary gangsters who are the sort of proteges of the original executioners, and he says, We need our gangsters to be able to beat people up so we as politicians or businessmen can get things done. And we see the vice president, this vice president, by the way, is current, who says we need to be able to beat people up, is now the head of the Indonesian Red Cross and launching a presidential bid in 2014 alongside three other candidates, two war criminals, one of whom is on a blacklist, not allowed to come to the U.S. because of his role in the East Timor massacres. One, a Suharto-era real estate mogul who's a multi-billionaire and uses thugs in every aspect of his business. You see, the killings didn't stop in 1965. They continued on a lower scale and in different regions, wherever it suited the regime. There was mass killing in East Timor, where 200 out of 600,000 people died as a result of the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. They continue today in West Papua. In 1998, the army instigated pogroms against Chinese residents of Jakarta. Thousands and thousands of Chinese people were killed. Shopping malls in Chinese areas were locked with the choppers inside and then set alight. The act of killing bears witness to a moral, cultural, and political vacuum.
Absolutely.
That becomes inevitable when you build your normality on terror and lies.
Well, and speaking of vacuum, the same vice president, as he explains to these young fighters, that the word gangster comes from the English phrase, free man. This nation needs free men and gangsters to get things done. So again, you're recreating the reality. And one of the characters, Adi, I find very interesting, who comes in, because he does seem to say, well, wait a minute, if we're telling this story, people will counter this. And you ask him about being a war criminal, and he says, war crimes are defined by the winners. And I'm a winner, so I make my own definition, and not the Geneva Conventions. And I thought that pretty much sums up this entire situation. You are the winner, so you are making the definitions, you are creating the narrative, and everyone is supposed to follow along. The soap opera that you've created, everyone has to be a character in it.
Well, there's two things there that are really fascinating. I think Anwar, as you've said, is suffering from trauma as a result of what he's done. And when I filmed him the first time dancing on the roof, I showed that material back to him because I wanted to know, will he recognize some of the meaning which he's in, which he's evidently denying by dancing there. Will he recognize it in the mirror of the movie? And he watches that material very disturbed. And I'm sure he's disturbed about what the material shows, that he's, well, the killings. But he does not dare admit it because he's never been forced to admit it, unlike perpetrators in Cambodia. He's trying and he's clinging to the excuse that it was right. So instead he displaces that disturbance onto his trousers. He says, I look like I'm dressed for a picnic. My acting is wrong. And so began this surreal process
my hair,
of embellishment. This surreal process of embellishment where he proposes scene after scene after scene, each one more surreal than the previous, each one in direct reaction to the previous. We would shoot one scene at a time. He would watch it and say what he wanted to shoot next. That was the method. And all the time, what's fueling that process is him trying to run away from the pain that the same process is dredging up for him. So it's a kind of anti-therapeutic process. But because of that, in hindsight, it's not surprising that these reenactments become the prism through which he recognizes the horror of what he's done. But I was not trying to lead him to remorse. I was harvesting, if you like, these reenactments
right, right.
as instances of impunity, as allegories for the moral rot of a whole regime on behalf of survivors and the human rights community who had entrusted me with exposing this regime for Indonesians. So there was this tension between our projects. At some point, Anwar brings Adi into the film. Adi comes into the film, his old friend from childhood and former Death Squad fellow executioner. And Adi comes in saying, everything we did was wrong. The government should apologize. The communists were not the cruel ones. We were. The propaganda justifying all of this is a lie. And the question, I don't know what he's doing. Is he showing off? Is he saying, look to his friends, fellow gangsters, fellow killers, I'm so tough that I can admit it was wrong and still sleep easily at night.
Exactly.
Or is he reassuring himself that he's a good person by playing at remorse, playing at being magnanimous, at having this big soul and saying there should be truth and reconciliation? I'm not sure. But the moment he sees the reenactments and sees the potential power of the reenactments to turn this history completely on its head, he gets cold feet. And he said, warns everybody, this is going to make us look bad. Do you not see what this film is going to do? It's going to completely turn the dominant story on its head. And he withdraws from the film. And everybody else continues. They don't care. They don't heed his warning. And I think it's because Anwar is not trying to look good by making this film, which is why he stands by the finished film and is moved by it. Anwar is trying to deal with his pain, actually. The film has provided him an occasion to work something out, to address something and run away from something at the same time, and paradoxically, that's been haunting him the whole time. And that the official story, which has not created a space for, you know, to tell himself it was right, he knows it's a lie. So it's never provided him the solace. It's like a quick fix, the official history. Oh, yeah, it was right. It was heroic. So there's this moment towards the end of the film, which is very telling, where Anwar plays the victim. He experiences real trauma there. He comes to it in the most... It doesn't matter. This people need to see, but he plays the victim. He experiences real trauma as though to wash, cleanse himself of that. He next proposes this scene of his redemption in heaven, where with dancing girls and a choral version of Born Free in the soundtrack, his own victims are there presenting him with a medal, thanking him for killing them and sending them to heaven. And this is a moment that Indonesians both cry when they see and laugh, because finally the true nature of this regime has been exposed. So it's a cathartic and wonderful moment for younger Indonesians. But it's a quick fix for Anwar. Anwar says he watches the scene. He says, it's wonderful. I love it. But put on that. Now, then it's not sufficient. He says, but put on the scene where I'm strangled with wire. Because the lie doesn't provide the lasting solace that he needs. And the horrible ending of the film, but it's also hopeful somehow, is that nothing can provide the lasting solace that Anwar needs, because Anwar has destroyed himself. So sometimes people say to me, Was Anwar stupid to participate in your film? Well, first of all, as I said a moment ago, Anwar stands by the finished film. But the much more important point was, no, Anwar was stupid to participate in the killings. That's where he made the wrong choice. The film, he was destroyed ever since. And Adi, to come back finally to your question about Adi in the car, Adi says, war crimes are defined by the winner. I'm a winner. I can make my own definition. It's in the middle of a very tense argument with me after he's realized the film will make him look bad. He's left the film. But then he says something very important, which is not in the film. I say, what happens if you're taken to The Hague? He says, take me to The Hague. I'll be famous. That's the end of the scene in the film. Then he says, Josh, you know I'll never be taken to The Hague, because the West has no interest in prosecuting this. And we should remember that when people ask me, what can the West do? We should remember that the genocide of 1965, the ongoing human rights violations, the mass the genocide in East Timor, the ongoing violations of that government, the use of gangsters by politicians and companies so that Western companies as well can use gangsters to break strikes or kick people off their land or keep my friends who are plantation workers and were forced to poison themselves on the job, too afraid to organize a union. This is the West's vision for Indonesia. The act of killing shows the West's vision for Indonesia, and not just Indonesia, but everywhere we have sweatshops. Everything we buy is produced in places like the Indonesia of the act of killing, and in that sense, all of us are dependent on Anwar and his friends or men like him for our daily survival, our daily living, and we know this, and this definitely damages us. We have one chance to live on this planet, and it is a shame, it is a loss, it is a pity that we live on the back of other people's suffering. This is not to say you should go out and buy organic apples. We need a much more profound solution, and it is a shame. And the film says, asks us in seeing a small part of ourselves in Anwar Kongo, it asks us to recognize that we are much closer to perpetrators than we like to think, that the entire edifice which underpins almost all of our journalism and entertainment, that the world is divided into good guys and bad guys, is a lie. And it is a profoundly destructive lie because we fail to see the nature of the problems that we have because we think we are good and that the evil is perpetrated by evil as opposed to much bigger, much more systemic problems.
And even if we are not the exact perpetrator, we are complicit in all of it. I mean, the U.S. has direct complicity, but everybody does. And I was going to ask you, is everyone in Indonesia now an actor? Everyone seemed to be acting out a different role here based on the image, the facade, but it seems that all of us are.
Everybody. Yeah, I think we all are. And I think that the film has come to Indonesia as I hoped it would, like The Child in the Emperor's New Clothes. They ban films in Indonesia, particularly films dealing with Indonesian human rights violations. So to avoid, and if they were to ban the act of killing, if we just simply after its premiere submitted it to the censorship board, it would be banned, we thought it back then, that last September. So to avoid that, and if it's banned, it becomes a crime to screen the film at all. If it's a crime to screen the film, then that's an excuse for the paramilitary groups in Indonesia or the army to physically attack screenings, and with impunity. So to avoid that, all last autumn, we held screenings at the National Human Rights Commission in Jakarta for Indonesia's leading journalists, filmmakers, human rights advocates, historians, educators, survivors groups, artists, news producers, news publishers, everybody who saw the film was deeply moved by it and said, we have to screen this film. We have to talk about this after the act of killing. There's a time before the act of killing. There's a time after. There's no going back. And this, so starting with Indonesia's leading news magazine, Tempo, Tempo magazine, imagine you're the editor of Tempo magazine. You're part of the establishment.
Speaking of complicity, yes.
You're faced with a pretty stark choice watching this film. You see men who, if they were the heroes they claim to be, should be enjoying the fruits of their heroic victory in their old age. Instead, they're ravaged by what they've done, destroyed in the case of Anwar, a hollow shell of humanity in the case of Adi. And you're faced with this choice. Do you want to grow old as a perpetrator? And so, starting with Tempo magazine, the Indonesia's news establishment took a pretty brave choice and said, no, we have to break our silence about what happened. And so Tempo published a special double edition of its magazine. They sent dozens of journalists around the country to prove that what the act of killing shows is systemic, and the act of killing itself is essentially a repeatable experiment. They found killers all over the country who were boastful about their role in the 1965-66 genocide, and amassed hundreds of pages of boastful storytelling from perpetrators in just a few weeks. Published 75 pages of perpetrators boasting, plus 25 pages about the film in a special double edition of the magazine that came out last October 1st. It sold out immediately. They reprinted it. It sold out again. They reprinted it. It sold out a third time.
So there's such hunger for this.
So, and then the rest of the media followed suit and published their own special reports. Then all the people who'd seen it in the autumn last year said, we have to show this film. How do we do it? So we said, take it back to your networks. If you're in a university, hold big public screenings because you maybe don't have to go through the censors there. If you're in a private venue, hold them by invitation only. On the 10th of December last year, International Human Rights Day, there were 50 screenings in 30 cities ranging in size between 30 people and 700 people. And that grew ever since. So as of April, there were 500 screenings in 95 cities. Then we lost count. But every week, there's more screenings than the previous week. And the film has really transformed the way Indonesia talks about its past. The film has come to Indonesia exactly as the survivors wished it would, like the child in the emperor's new clothes.
And what do you think will be the lasting impact of this? Will there be tribunals, or is the point just to have a national conversation about this?
Well, of course, there is, in fact, a movement to have first a presidential apology, then a truth commission, tribunals, a truth and reconciliation process, all of which was recommended by an 850-page National Human Rights Commission report that was published last August, but was sadly rejected by the Indonesian Attorney General's office on the grounds that it's not sufficiently detailed, although it's 850 pages.
Of course.
And then the Attorney General commented that if the killings were justified, because if they hadn't occurred, Indonesia would not be what it is today, which is darkly what the film shows.
Wow.
So there is a movement now to have those recommendations accepted. And there is, in fact, a petition that listeners can go online and sign, www.saysorryfor65.org. I encourage everybody to do so and tell their friends. But So far, the government, the important ministries that have the power to deal with these things have kept quiet about the film. But I'm still optimistic. I've been astounded by the curiosity, the bravery, the love, the critical interest that younger Indonesians have, and who are becoming leaders of today's Indonesia, and are saying essentially, we don't want to be complicit with atrocity in our lives. And they're taking a very brave stance, much like my crew. I have in the credits of the act of killing, you'll see 60 or 70 people credited as anonymous. All of these are people who gave 8 years of their lives knowing they couldn't put their name on the film until there's real political change in Indonesia. And for the same reason, I cannot go to Indonesia now. There is a wonderful new generation of Indonesians that can only make one hopeful.
I am speaking with filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer, and speaking of bravery, this was an extraordinary film. The Act of Killing will be released in theaters this August 9th. Can you tell me about your relationship now with Anwar? I had read some accounts where he felt tricked by it. This was supposed to be a love story initially, but then you all were able to really have a conversation around it.
Anwar ever felt tricked. Anwar was called to a press conference by the leaders of Pancasila Youth before he'd seen the film. As I was finishing the film, I was saying to Anwar again and again, can I come and show you the film? Can we hold a screening for you? And Anwar again and again would say, no, not yet. Not yet. I'm not ready to see the film yet. Because as you'll see, when you see the film, he knows what's in the film. He's watching scenes throughout the film. It's a painful process for him, and it could only be a painful experience to watch this film if you are the main character. Anwar decides, then the film came out. It was last year at the Toronto Film Festival. It was a very painful week of trying to explain to him the reaction every night on the phone for an hour to the nature of the film, what's in it, why people are reacting as they're reacting. But once it came out, it was a big news story in Indonesia. And the paramilitary group held a press conference with Anwar, where they called Anwar to talk about the film. Of course, at that press conference, Anwar had to say he was betrayed, because otherwise he would be blamed by these powerful paramilitary leaders for destroying the image of their organization. So he did say so. But he hadn't seen the film. And he then spoke to an Al Jazeera journalist, Step Vassen from the Netherlands, and said rather contradictory things about how close he and I are. But he said to me, Josh, I now need to see the film since I'm the center of this news story. So at that point, it was no longer safe for me to go to Indonesia. I could probably get into Indonesia, but I don't think I would get out again. And I didn't think I could bring Anwar out of Indonesia necessarily either, because he was in the news for mass killing. So we arranged for him to fly to Jakarta to a comfortable hotel with excellent internet connection so I could be with him throughout the screening by Skype. Mm. We screened the film for him. And he was very quiet after the film. He was very moved. He was tearful. He went, after sitting for a long time in silence, he went to the bathroom, pulled himself together, came back and said, Josh, this film shows what it's like to be me. I'm glad I was able to be so honest. I will stand by this film. And I, of course, said, you don't have to stand by this film, Anwar. But he has since that day. And he and I remain in touch every 3 to 4 weeks.
Wow. That is a beautiful story and an ending there. It's, wow. How did you deal with your secondary trauma? I mean, it's so profoundly traumatic, even to be a viewer of the reenactments, even knowing that they're reenacting. And this is not the first time you've dealt with death squads and cases of mass murder. How did you do this?
Well, I insisted to myself that even though I would never for a second forget my condemnation of what these men have done, I would always remain, I would never also for a second condemn Anwar as a human being. I would separate the crime from the person. People can say, how can you humanize these people? Well, the answer is very simple. They're human. Mm-hmm. So I always insisted on myself that I see them as human. And I don't think I can make an honest film about how a human being in all of her complexity without becoming very close. And so I also made myself insisted that I become close. That was difficult, because when you're close to somebody, you're vulnerable to them. And so when I would hear these horrific stories, witness these horrific reenactments, it would be painful. There was a period, sort of the last third of the film. You've seen the full director's cut of the mm-hmm. film. There's this brutal last third. And in that section, when we shot that, it gave me nightmares, which then were so awful. I had insomnia for a couple nights in a row, and then I would have it again. And that went on for 6 or 8 months of really not sleeping, alternating between sleeplessness and nightmares. I guess I got through it because I have a wonderful partner and because my Indonesian crew are so loving and so committed and lit what was a very dark and painful journey with their laughter and with their care and with their constant reminder of how important this is.
It is a remarkable film, The Act of Killing. It will be in theaters August 9th. It showed in Santa Fe, sold out pretty immediately here. Incredibly brave. What is next for you? You've already won many, many awards for this, and it may just be the beginning, correct?
Well, the film is opening in the U.S. right now. I'm in the middle of editing my new film, which is a film with the working title, The Look of Silence. It's about a family of survivors with whom I started this journey, who come to find out who killed their son through my work with perpetrators, and decide that they need to, in order to reassure themselves as they raise young children of their own, in order to reassure themselves that the perpetrators and their children living around them are indeed fully human, they want to meet the perpetrators, confront them, and see if they can take responsibility and feel some remorse for what they've done. And they go and they confront every perpetrator involved with their son's death. And it is that is unimaginable in Indonesia. And so we feel in these confrontations exactly all of the taboos that this family is breaking by doing this, and consequently the nature of the silence that they're living under.
You don't take on light subject matter very often, do you?
Well, Werner Herzog, who's one of the executive producers of the film, has also been, while I've been doing this, has been making a series of films about death row, and said to me as he finished the last one, "Josh, now we need to make an Eddie Murphy comedy." So after this, I won't make an Eddie Murphy comedy, but I think there's a lot of mileage still in the method that I've used in The Act of Killing, and I am eager to bring that method to the United States and do something here with it.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Joshua Oppenheimer. The film is The Act of Killing. Go and see this extraordinary film. It really is one of the most stunning, even just in terms of the photography, the most stunning, amazing, strange film I have ever seen. Thank you so, so much for being here. The film will be screening at the CCA here in Santa Fe. For more information, go to ccasantafe.org.